It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Nirvana, Pearl Jam, Weezer, Foo Fighters, all of them owe their massive success to Marco Collins. As a DJ for 107.7 The End here in Seattle, Marco Collins was the first person to play these bands on the radio. He's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame for breaking hit after hit and becoming a tastemaker and a gatekeeper in the music industry.
Without Marco as the loudspeaker, there's no way that alternative music becomes, you know, the global phenomenon that it became. No way.
That's a clip from a new documentary about Marco Collins. It's called The Glamour and the Squalor. Yes, both sides of his story are here, as well as the way he handled being quietly gay in a mostly straight world of grunge. First, Marco told me about his fascination for the dark side of things, which he connects to hearing a certain song for the first time. Happy House by Susie and the Banshees.
It was about the spookiest, most, you know, intense, just it frightened the hell out of me. When I heard that song, I remember sitting in a girlfriend's bedroom thinking, okay, now I don't get it. Now I really don't get it. But there's something I'm attracted to in how disturbed I am by it. I seem to be attracted to dangerous things. I don't know. Things that really destroy me or disturb me.
How did you start thinking, I want to expose other people to this disturbing or spooky stuff?
Yeah, I think
it was for you.
Yeah, I think, you know, radio was just exciting to me. And I was a kid that listened to the radio nonstop, you know, from when I can remember. I used to have 8 tracks. And you remember those, Bill?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Just, you know, I mean, it was one of those things that I would tape Casey Kasem. Because I wanted to hear those top songs.
I recorded Casey Kasem. Yeah, the top weekend top 40. It was coast to coast.
Yeah. Coast to coast, exactly. It was
America's top 40.
Yeah. I can hear the jingle
as
you say that in my
head. American top 40.
Yeah, it was great, man. And I think I just was very attracted to the medium that you could share with people this knowledge and this information. And that, to me, was just very exciting. I did my first show when I was 16. And it was on an overnight at a community station in Northern California. And it didn't matter to me. I remember putting a 7-inch single on the turntable and hearing those opening riffs of Agent Orange, Everything's Got Gray. Just made me think, you're communicating with so many people that were like you at one point who had never heard this. And to me, I don't know, it's just exciting. It was something I was really drawn to.
You felt that when people started calling you at the station, or just the airing
just
of the
notes,
music?
Yeah, just the notes. I pictured actually the notes going out on the airwaves. I pictured like the sounds actually, you know, climbing through the clouds and, like, you know, piercing other people's ears. It just was one of those things that to me was exciting. It's about communication, it's about sharing, and to me, music has to be enjoyed by more than one person. And that's always something. I can download every fantastic record in the world and listen to it by myself, but how much better does it sound when you're sharing it with somebody else? Like, so much better.
You were the one who, at least you get credit for sharing with everybody else, Nirvana, Pearl Jam, later bands after that. You would play stuff before anybody else did. What did you hear in songs?
Again, it goes back to, I'm a fan of pop music, and people have touted me as being this alternative genius, and I just like pop songs, man. Like, you know, going all the way back to the Beatles, you know, and even before that, it's just a song structure that works in my head. It's not complicated at all. And to me, you can dress that up any way. And all of these bands, God, Kurt Cobain borrowed more from, you know, the
Boston.
Beatles than, yeah, Boston and the Pixies, you know. But it was all, there's still a structure to it, you know. And he jokes about verse, chorus, verse. It's, you know, it's a structure that works, man, and it's a structure that works with the human mind. And to me, that's what I heard, and I knew that's what radio needed.
Marco Collins, you said that people want their rock stars to be rock stars, and that's who you thought you were. What did you mean by that?
I just remember thinking, if people are going to identify with my show, I need to live the lifestyle. I need to get out in the middle of it all and live the lifestyle. I need to be not just going to the shows. I need to be hanging out with the bands. I need to be partying with the bands. I need to be doing whatever the bands are.
Do you like doing that?
Yeah, it was a blast.
Okay.
It was a blast. And I like creative people. I get along very well with creative people. And it's inspiring for me to be around people that are, you know, so dynamic. So, it was a lot of fun. And when I first got here, I remember, so I started hanging out with a guy named Nils Bernstein. Nils ran the Nirvana fan club out of his apartment on Capitol Hill. Little tiny apartment. And when Nirvana blew up, literally, I watched his living room. Like, this is a place we just all drank beer, crappy couch, you know, spilling beer all over the hardwood floors. You know, I watched his apartment get filled with fan mail from all over the world. Literally, we would have parties and dive into stacks of fan mail that were 3 feet high. And his mailman hated him. It was a great sort of place to be. But I remember once being over at Nils' house, and we were all getting together to watch Nirvana play on Saturday Night Live for the first time. We were all sitting on the couch, and it was Dan Peters from Mudhoney, and it was Kurt Block from the Fastbacks and the Young Fresh Fellows. It was like I looked around the room and thought, my God, this scene is tight. These are all the bands that the rest of the world are looking at, and we're all right here partying together. And I remember when Nirvana took the stage and everybody shut up. You know, everybody was drinking and unruly. Everybody shut up, got deadly silent. And when Nirvana's performance was over, you could hear a pin drop in that room. And it was, I get chills even talking about it. It was one of those moments that you really recognized that this grunge thing is way bigger than any of us had thought. These are Kurt's friends. You know, punk rockers and just crazy, maniacal fools. And they're all just shutting up and looking at the TV like they just saw one of the most important moments in pop culture history. And that's what it was.
So it was cool. It was fun. Were there any downsides to...
Of course there were.
...that life? Let's talk about that.
Okay. Well, you know, I mean, when you're in the thick of it all, there were a lot of drugs going on, and I ingested a lot of drugs back then. And, you know, some people in the scene didn't make it out. You know, some people OD'd, and some people ended up taking their own lives because of, you know, whatever pressures were going on and whatever sort of drugs they were putting into their body. That part was rough, you know, that part was rough, but it was also in a weird way, part of the beauty of it all too. And I don't want to say that the destructive nature of it, but you know, there's an element of pushing the boundaries that to me was fun. It's part of what we all did, and things got really out of control. I did a lot of cocaine. A lot of cocaine.
I can sort of understand why a musician who's got to get up for shows and has a weird schedule and can't sleep, and then their life might be twisted around by money and attention and all that stuff, and drugs being a part of that. Why were you taking drugs?
I liked it. I liked how it made me feel. So I would get off the air, start partying like a madman. And my rule was I had to be in bed by noon the next day to be able to do my radio shift again. So we raged all night. I mean, we raged, went to clubs. You know, at that time, the electronic thing had really taken off. I had turntables in my loft. It just really lended itself to the party. And it just got to be too much.
What did all that cost you?
Cost me a lot. I mean, it cost me...
And you know
me,
I don't just mean money, obviously.
No, clearly, yeah. In fact, money is the least of the concerns. You know, there's a huge trade-off. You trade off everything. You trade off relationships. That's a biggie for me, is walking away from, you know, relationships that I had been in that, you know, could have been long-term, like settling down kind of relationships. And I walked away from those. I walked away from, you know, a career. I blew up my career.
You mentioned relationships.
Yeah.
When you were on the air during the 90s, your listeners didn't know you were gay.
No.
Some, you know, Kurt Cobain and some other musicians knew,
but it was
the scene knew.
The scene knew, yeah.
Why didn't the rest of us know?
It was just a different time. It wasn't as acceptable to come out then, especially, you know, when you had a following. You know, I had my ratings were number one at nights, and my audience was 16-year-old kids, 16 to 18 to, you know, 24-year-old kids. It was mainly a very male, you know, oriented audience. And I just knew they're not going to be down with this. And I can actually remember, you know, there were a couple scares where I thought my audience has found out I was gay. And that's in the movie as well.
Yeah.
Some funny moments with that in the movie where I get outed on stage.
On stage.
In front of, yeah.
Except you weren't, sort of.
Except I wasn't, yeah. Just awkward. But I remember being terrified by that, you know. And then it ended up being sort of a really funny realization that maybe nobody does care. You know, maybe nobody really does care. But it just wasn't something, you know. So I'll tell you this. I came out in 1996, throughout magazine, they came to town to do a piece on gay musicians in Seattle. And they had Patty from Hole. They had myself. They had Nils, who ran Nirvana's fan club. They had a couple other artists. And they wanted to focus on people in the scene that were gay. And so I came out, and I was so nervous when Out Magazine was going to come out. The world was going to know. And then I realized only gay people read Out Magazine. So, you know, you're real worried about this. And it came out, and, you know, I had a couple people that called me up and said, hey, we didn't know you were gay.
Any regrets?
Yes, I do have regrets. I have regrets that I didn't come out early, because now I'm getting – I get emails from people that – have grown up now and found their own way and come out on their own that said, if we had known that you were gay back then, it would have made it so much easier on us. And so, yeah, of course I have regrets. I mean, it would have been great to inspire a younger generation and just be sort of, well, I was far from a role model, but just be open about my sexuality to let other people know it's all right. I just wasn't that comfortable then. And I regret that. Yeah, I do.
Did being gay influence you, help you as a DJ, or a non-factor?
It helped me in this scene, you know, the Seattle scene. So I got here, and I've always kind of had a very – I've never looked the alternative kid. I've never looked, you know, except for my high school years. I was really into the punk rock thing. I always looked like a soccer player. You know, just very mainstream, frat boy-looking soccer player. But it was when the scene found out that I wasn't just a California boy that was, you know, out of a fraternity here in town, that I was actually gay. They felt that, at least this is my take, that I was also a misfit in a way and fit into what they believed was a scene full of misfits.
Marco Collins, you're in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as a DJ. You helped create all these successful bands, or helped break these successful bands. As you know, radio doesn't have the same power as it did back then. What do you want to accomplish now in the music world?
Well, I don't totally agree with you that radio doesn't have the power,
okay,
to break these artists, or to be a part of, you know, pushing something over the top. What I think is happening is commercial radio is becoming terrified of it, and it's making room for stations like KCRW in Los Angeles, KCMU. Jeez, I'm throwing right back.
KEXP.
Thank you, KEXP. Just fantastic stations. WOXY. These stations are growing because people want something different. People want to hear the next thing. People want to be turned on to new bands.
What's your part in that today?
Hell, I don't know, Bill. I really don't know.
You're how old now?
I'm 51.
Yeah. So are you still trying to be a tastemaker, a band breaker?
I mean, yeah, you know, I mean, it's something that I don't think goes away. I do notice this, though. As my friends get older, they stop being interested in new music. And there's a study out there somewhere that says when you hit 32 or 33, you stop putting new music in your car. You're listening to only the things that you loved when you were younger. That never happened to me. But, you know, I'm more excited about what's coming out in the next year. I'm excited about where music is going now. And I just, I keep my focus on that, because the moment I think you sort of rest, or the moment I rest and stop pursuing those new bands, is the moment that you can just put me to bed. You could put me in the retirement home and just, you know, I'll be done at that point.
Seattle DJ Marco Collins is in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, known for jump-starting the careers of Nirvana and Pearl Jam and so many others. Again, that film about his life, his journey, is called The Glamour and the Squalor. It's available on iTunes and Amazon Video, and we're tweeting out a link to the trailer right now at KUOW.